Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. Today, we're focusing on the United States and the historic change in its relations with Cuba in partnership with PRI's America Abroad. In December of last year, President Obama made an announcement.
Today, the United States of America is changing its relationship with the people of Cuba.
This set in motion a string of policy changes, and representatives for each country are now hammering out the details, however gradually.
We will begin to normalize relations between our two countries. Through these changes, we intend to create more opportunities for the American and Cuban people and begin a new chapter among the nations of the Americas.
Now, I'm putting this mildly. The reactions to this have been mixed. Senator Robert Menendez of New Jersey had this to say.
If you're going to normalize relationships, you gave everything the Castro regime has wanted and has had advocates for here in the United States, and you got nothing in return.
Cuban exiles here in the U.S. came out and protested. But to others, the opening of relations with Cuba means so much. Economic opportunity and free trade are important factors. Abel Garcia is a barber and a painter in Cuba.
Por ejemplo, hay muchos productos, sobre todo en el ámbito de la medicina, equipos de la medicina.
There are lots of products, especially in the field of medicine and medical equipment, and a whole bunch of things that can be bought in the United States, which is closer and cheaper. And yet, Cuba has to invest and buy these items elsewhere from places that are much farther away and more expensive.
And for many Cuban Americans, much like other Latinos, the idea of reunification with family members weighs heavily.
So I still have a sister in Cuba, and she has a daughter who's still there, who just had a baby a couple of weeks ago. So she's a new grandmother.
Isis Fernandez Rojas lives in Texas. She's half Cuban, half Guatemalan. Her father came over to the U.S. to evade authorities during the 1970s, and her family just isn't able to come to the United States.
They can't come here for birthdays or for Christmas or for any of the big events. It's very limited to what we actually can say to each other. We don't really talk about politics, and we don't really talk about what we think about things.
So when she heard President Obama's announcement, Isis got, well, emotional.
The floodgates just opened. I sat down here in my office, and I needed to take 5-10 minutes to myself and just said, wow, this is big. I mean, this can actually be huge for my family.
Today, we're going to spend some time exploring the personal stories, the family histories, and the politics around the changing U.S.-Cuban relationship. But to start, we're going to leap back a bit in history, to the late 1400s.
It was precisely to these shores that Columbus sailed his ships 5 centuries ago.
You're probably familiar with the poem. In 1492, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. And that's the year he first encountered the island, about 90 miles south of what is now the Florida Keys. It was then occupied by indigenous tribes. Columbus claimed this island for the Spanish Empire, and for more than 400 years, it remained under Spanish rule. Then, in the late 19th century, a group of Cuban revolutionaries stood up against the crown. The United States was watching closely. University of North Carolina history professor Luis Perez.
The nightmare of American statesmen from Adams and Jefferson, and perhaps even deep into the 20th century, is that a hostile European power would locate itself in Cuba and thereby threaten American strategic interest, maritime interest, commercial interest, economic interest.
So, in 1898, the U.S. intervened in the revolution, and with the Cuban rebels, they defeated Spain. The Cubans longed for independence. But the U.S. worried about European intervention if another revolt sprung up. Their solution was the Platt Amendment.
Cuba is denied the right to make treaties with other countries. Cuba has to cede territory sufficient for an American naval station. And then finally, that Cuba concedes to the United States the right to intervene when in the judgment of the United States, and the phrase was life, liberty, and property, were menaced.
Over the next 30 years, the U.S. sent troops to Cuba 3 times to put down local rebellions. But the Cubans were becoming resentful of the United States. Beginning in the 1930s, the U.S. took a new approach to Latin America with the Good Neighbor Policy. President Franklin Roosevelt addressed this change in 1936.
The American Republic to the south of us have been ready always to cooperate with the United States on a basis of equality and mutual respect. But before we inaugurated the good neighbor policy, there was among them resentment and fear because certain administrations in Washington had slighted their national pride and their sovereign rights.
In many Latin American countries, the U.S. did take a more hands-off approach, but Cuba was too important. Following another revolt in 1933, the United States helped install Fulgencio Batista. He would go on to dominate Cuban politics for the next 25 years.
For 6 years, the army has run the country and Batista has been virtual dictator. Here is one strong man who is well-loved, who has ruled wisely and preserved freedom.
Batista instituted labor and economic reforms, and for a time led the island through a period of stability. UNC history professor Luis Perez says he also helped deepen Cuba's political and cultural ties to the U.S.
Tens of thousands of Cubans are educated in the United States. Hundreds of Cuban army officers are trained by the Department of Defense. And with that comes a Cuban affection for American culture.
Oh, would you like to spend the weekend in Havana? How would you like to...
But America's relationship with Cuba had a darker side.
The arrival of organized crime, the presence of the mafia, gambling, prostitution, drugs. The country is slowly perceiving itself to becoming this very distasteful cesspool of the worst elements of American popular culture.
During the 1940s and 50s, Batista's rule became increasingly repressive and corrupt. Growing resistance to Batista soon turned violent.
In front of the presidential palace in Havana, nearly a million people, which is just about the whole population of this capital city, gathered at the bidding of their new leader, Fidel Castro. The summary courts-martial and executions of Batista followers have brought criticisms from abroad, especially America. Castro wanted to know how his countrymen felt on the subject, and the hysterical reception shows that Cubans would support just about anything he did.
The Cuban people were fed up with political violence and corruption that had plagued Cuba for decades. Historian Luis Perez.
The power of Fidel Castro lay in part in his capacity to summon a vision of dignity, of independence. And a large part of that was this unrelenting attack on the United States for the misdeeds of the previous 50, 60 years. So this becomes one of the central elements by which Fidel Castro mobilizes politically the Cuban people.
For American officials, the rise of this communist leader reignited old fears of a hostile government just off America's shore. Castro fueled those fears by nationalizing American businesses. In 1961, the U.S. broke off diplomatic relations with Cuba. Soon after, the CIA devised a plan in which a group of Cuban dissidents, armed and trained by the CIA, would attack the island at the Bay of Pigs. But the mission failed.
On April 17th, mercenary gangs supported by the United States began an armed attack on our country. We replied with mobilization of the entire people, and we went to meet the invaders. The enemy was confused. He had thought that our defense would crumble under the very first attack. He did not expect all the Cuban people to rise against him.
This was an embarrassment to the Kennedy administration and only strengthened Fidel Castro's grip on Cuba. The Cuban people were hopeful that the revolution would bring democracy, but Castro had other plans. This from a 1961 BBC interview.
You obviously have a great deal of support among the people of Cuba, Dr. Castro. Why, in that case, do you not hold elections on a democratic basis?
We ask it to the people. People said we don't want political now because we are working. And political was good only for robbers and for criminals. We are building the house. After build the house, we will find the house and we'll organize the house.
The new Cuban leader looked to the Soviet Union as his model. And for its part, the U.S. imposed an economic embargo on the island, cutting off exports to Cuba, ending travel to the island from the U.S., and a host of other sanctions. At the same time, Cuba and the Soviet Union became increasingly friendly. President Kennedy addressed the American people on the evening of October 22, 1962.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island.
Theodore Sorensen was a speechwriter and top advisor for President Kennedy at the time. He talks about the most critical moment of that two-week standoff, 5 days after Kennedy's announcement.
That Saturday, the news was all bad.
First, a fleet of Soviet submarines was seen heading for the American blockade. Next, a U.S. reconnaissance plane was shot down.
Then, a U.S. Air Force plane based, I believe, in Alaska. His navigation controls malfunctioned, and he flew over Siberia. What were the Soviets to think? Presumably, they thought it was the beginning of World War III. Word of all this reached the XCOM, and there was a grimace around the table. JFK broke the silence by saying, there's always one SOB who doesn't get the message.
On October 28th, the two superpowers stopped just short of nuclear war. For the Kennedy administration, the Cuban Missile Crisis was seen as evidence of just how dangerous a hostile Cuba could be. The Soviet Union continued to support Fidel Castro's regime for 3 decades after the Cuban Missile Crisis, supplying the island with nearly $6 billion in annual aid. And when the Iron Curtain fell in 1991, Cuba was hit hard. UNC professor Luis Perez describes a dramatic shift on the island.
All of a sudden, this economy just came to a grinding halt, and in many ways, it goes back in time. The tractors were replaced by oxen, cars were replaced by bicycles, factories closed down, buses ceased to operate.
When we come back, we'll pick up our history of U.S.-Cuban relations after the end of the Cold War, and we'll hear personal stories of exiles here in the U.S. and about the lives of Cubans on the island building businesses today. Welcome back. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this is a special collaboration between Latino USA and America Abroad, Cuba and America after the thaw. We left off our history with the collapse of the Soviet Union. Cuba was in rough shape, and their economic woes forced the communist leadership to undertake small market reforms. But the communist regime remained firmly in place, and American presidents stayed firm in their closed-door policy towards Cuba. In 1992, Congress passed the Cuban Democracy Act, strengthening the sanctions that had been in place since the 1960s. President George H.W. Bush signed the bill in front of an enthusiastic Miami audience.
For freedom to rise in Cuba, Fidel Castro must fall. And
the Clinton administration considered easing the embargo until March of 1996.
In broad daylight and without justification, Cuban military jets shot down 2 unarmed United States civilian aircraft, causing the deaths of 3 American citizens and 1 U.S. resident.
This led to the signing of the Helms-Burton Act, which implemented some of the toughest sanctions on Cuba to date. In 2006, Raul Castro took the reins from his ailing brother Fidel. But with few signs of any real change in Cuba, President George W. Bush held firm to the same position of 9 American presidents before him. This from October of 2007.
America will have no part in giving oxygen to a criminal regime victimizing its own people. We will not support the old way with new faces, the old system held together by new chains. The operative word in our future dealings with Cuba is not stability. The operative word is freedom.
But here we are, 8 years later, and there's been a major shift in tone and in policy. This from Obama's 2015 State of the Union address.
And on Cuba, we are ending a policy that was long past its expiration date. When what you're doing doesn't work for 50 years, it's time to try something new.
There's no timetable in place for the change, but attention is now focused on how the decline of the Castro brothers will affect relations with the United States.